You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Has the upcoming sequester deadline got you feeling depressed? Well, Planet Money co-founder and weekly New York Times Magazine columnist Adam Davidson suggests that there may be a real connection between the state of the economy and our personal happiness. He joins us today to talk about it, as well as the impact of changes in technology, the global economy, immigration policy, and more. And I'm very pleased to welcome Adam Davidson back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Lenny. Great to be here.
Most of your columns these days mention change, the rise of technology, the decrease in union membership, the increase in income disparity. As these paradigms change and create new economic issues, has the role of economists also changed?
Yeah, although I think economists are a little slow to recognize that in some ways. I keep hoping that one day I'm going to meet an economist who says, you know, things have happened so radically differently from how we expected over the last few years that I have fundamentally changed my opinions. Although what I keep finding is economists, almost all of them seem to only feel what they felt before this crisis, but more so, and that the other guys are wrong, but more so.
But then there's the whole matter of what a normal economy should look like. Should it look like what it was before all of this happened, or are we going to have a new normal economy?
Yeah, that's absolutely a crucial question, I think, for America right now, for the world right now, is what is the normal? What's the base? From 1982 to 2005, 2007, we had what economists at the time called the Great Moderation, this period of healthy economic growth with very little inflation, very little in the way of crises. And we handled the, you know, collapse of the Soviet Union without too much trouble here in the U.S.
Wait, was it really healthy economic growth? We had
it felt like healthy at the time. That's what I'm saying.
It ended up in disaster.
Yeah, we thought we had a period of healthy growth, I should say. You're exactly right. And now people are dramatically questioning that. And then, obviously, if you look at the late 70s, early 80s, that was a terrible time of high inflation, stagflation, high unemployment. But is the period just before that the right period? I mean, certainly the post-war U.S. economy was incredible, lots of jobs. But was that the normal, or was that just that we were the one industrialized economy that hadn't been destroyed in a world war and therefore was a complete aberration? So it's very hard to figure out what normal is these days.
Well, talking about aberrations, let's discuss the impending sequester. Cokie Roberts predicted on Morning Edition today that it's likely to happen. Do you agree?
It does seem that way, yeah. When you look at the interests aligned, it's hard to see any reason not to let it happen.
Well,
American people, we would not want it to happen.
Well, let's talk about the American people. Beyond those who receive their checks directly from the government or governmental agencies, how will the average American be affected by a sequester?
I think that There's short term and long term. So if it does continue for a very long period of time, I think the sort of conventional wisdom right now is it will start March 1st and will end by March 27th.
Because that's when the government runs out of money. So somebody's going to wind up coming up with some kind of an agreement.
They have to come up with some kind of agreement. I mean, apparently, the Republicans have done the math and feel like they can go March without solving this and not pay the price for it in the midterm elections. But if they go beyond March, they have a replay of the shutting down of government that Newt Gingrich paid a huge cost for. So 1 month is pretty bad. I mean, this is pretty embarrassing, but it's not chaotic. It's likely that most Americans will not directly experience, I buy the argument that we're going to see more delays on flights. I happen to have a few flights in March. I'm dreading that. But if it does continue much beyond that, we're talking about a massive chunk of spending in the U.S. economy taken out in a very chaotic way.
Well, the sequestration legislation was agreed to by both parties, and the president signed the bill. But polls indicate the majority of Americans do think that the Republicans are responsible for this current situation. Should they see both parties as equally culpable?
No, I don't think so. And this is a tough thing for us journalists to cover, especially people who do, I pride myself on being nonpartisan and not taking one particular side. And I certainly could give a long list of things Democrats have done that I find upsetting and would disagree with strongly. But in this case, I think while they're, you know, the standard phrase, there is plenty of blame to go around is true. There clearly is a contingent in the House of Republicans who don't see any reason to come up with a reasonable agreement that involves tax increases. And so I put it 70-30, 80-20 on them.
Can you clear something up for me? They don't say taxes. They say revenue. Why? Is revenue any better for the Republicans to use as a word?
I don't understand that, to be honest. I would think they would want to use taxes because revenue, I think, sounds better than taxes.
Well, maybe when they finally agree to some taxes, they could say, well, we just had to increase the revenue stream.
Right, right. Exactly. I don't know where that came about. You would think that would be something Democrats would have come up with and Republicans would hate. They want everything to be called taxes, taxes, taxes. That was the whole Justice Roberts decision about Obamacare, that it was a tax. And they were all excited that they got to call it a tax.
Well, in the end, do you think that Congress is likely to come up with a permanent solution or just another temporary fix like the legislation that's created this mess?
It seems that if you look at the field of economics called game theory, where you try and study the incentives on different people, it seems likely that we're going to continue this way, that there is not enough of a will on either side to do the things that would get the other side to agree to a deal. And both sides, and again, I do place the blame disproportionately, I will say, on a small group of House Republicans, do seem to really benefit from this constant chaos.
And they can continue to hold the line because their seats are considered safe.
Yes, yes. I mean, this is the whole issue that, and by the way, I consider myself an economics journalist, and this is very frustrating because it's almost anti-economics. It's a group of people throwing economics out the window and saying it doesn't apply. It's purely electoral math. But those people whose primary fear in an election is someone to the right of them because they know that they need to win a Republican primary that only a small percentage, even of Republicans, will vote in. They have a different set of incentives than a president who has to reach the whole country.
Isn't this one of the problems in even looking at economics as a science, that it's really as involved with politics as it is with any kind of theory?
Yeah, and that it's interesting to me that dealing with politics, with real-world politics, is considered a brand new and fairly controversial part of economics.
But it's always been there. The Depression, we were talking about similar things, weren't we?
Although the work of leading economists, the kind of stuff that got Nobel Prizes and really shifted the profession, was about mathematical models of the economy that really didn't include these kinds of political considerations. And it's been the last few years where you see more and more economists saying something along the lines of, our models don't matter. What matters is the incentive structures. What matters is how political players act. And there's still plenty of economists like Paul Krugman and others who don't think that should be in the field of economics so much, that the math is what economics brings to the table. And it's hard to do math about things like this.
Although Krugman has also gotten involved in talking about politics, the war in Iraq, for example, and that has led to some troubles, according to yesterday's Times, for him, because people wanted him to just stick to economics.
Right, right.
He's suggesting that it's all tied together these days.
Yes, although in the this gets into annoying nuances of academics, but in academic journals, the idea is we should just stick to economics and finance, according to some people. But there are more. You'll see more and more in the top economic journals, more and more about politics.
My guest is Adam Davidson, co-founder and co-host of Planet Money, and also the columnist at the New York Times, responsible for It's the Economy column. And in a recent installment of It's the Economy, one that you called Money Changes Everything, you wrote about how economists are pioneering or partnering with psychologists to map happiness, another area. Now, do the polls indicate that the public is unhappier because of this sequestration thing, or is that something that we're likely to see really become a problem after March 1st?
No, people are very unhappy about this. There's no question about that. And this is a point I really like to make. I mean, I grew up in Greenwich Village, and I live in New York City, and I know that sometimes those of us in the WNYC listening area can think you know, we have that kind of New Yorker cartoon version of the world that, oh, that's a bunch of right wingers and we don't understand them. The truth is, there is virtually nobody in America who supports this hard stance.
Except some Tea Party members.
Except not even the Tea Party members. When you poll the Tea Party members and you ask them, do you want substantial cuts on Social Security, Medicare, and defense, which make up 80% or something of spending? That's really what we're talking about when we're talking about spending cuts. They are not for it. And when you ask them, are you okay with some increases in taxes, they are okay with them. So it's virtually nobody. We're talking about single-digit percentages of Americans, if that, who really accept the full line of policy prescriptions that someone like Eric Cantor or Paul Ryan propose. A tiny minority of Republicans accept them. So I always like to point that out. This is not New York versus the rest of the world or rural versus urban. This is a very, very tiny percentage of Americans versus everybody else.
Well, according to a documentary I saw recently on PBS, the president has made that case to Eric Cantor and to Paul Ryan and others. He said the public rejected your economic policies, and that's why we won the re-election. And their answer is, well, we held on to the House, so the country is not 100% sure what it wants.
I would say the country is, I forget the exact numbers, but it is close to 80-90% sure that it wants a very strong and robust Social Security and Medicare and is willing to pay the taxes for it.
And that's why this sequestration law was put in place in the first place, because it was just so draconian that everybody figured something would be done. And here we are at a point where...
Yeah, well, exactly. This was the
it's
moment.
It's not happening.
We're not. I mean, I've been thinking all this week about mutually assured destruction under the Soviet Union, and this is basically a similar kind of model. Like, we'll create a situation. We won't allow small tactical nukes, because if you use any nukes anywhere, we're gonna use all the nukes everywhere. And this was supposed to be that model, but somehow it's become acceptable to use, you know, small tactical nukes when it comes to the U.S. government.
I was moving toward talking about the Easterland paradox, but we're going to go into a break. Can we do a short version and then do the longer version?
Yeah. Now, the Easterland paradox is on the outs in the academy, but the basic idea that Richard Easterland, an influential economist in California, had is that people do not seem to get happier as they get richer or as a country gets richer.
He never talked to me.
He didn't.
I was really depressed when I was very, very poor. And, you know, now I make enough of a comfortable living that I'm less depressed.
And you are one more evidence of proof that the original Easterland paradox does not hold up to data, except in the United States. And we can talk about that if you want in a little bit.
Because when people are polled, they reject the idea that money makes them happier?
It's not – you don't ask them, does money make you happier? What you ask are a series of questions about how you assess your well-being. And there's been a lot of work. Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize-winning psychologist at Princeton, you know, is pioneering in this. They come up with all sorts of ways. Probably the key way now is they sit you down. They ask you to think through your day yesterday and evaluate, all right, if yesterday was an average day – kind of where are you in your life?
Well, should we be surprised that psychologists should be working with economists? Because we also know that when people are feeling happier, they spend more money, don't they?
Yeah. Tomorrow we have the consumer confidence numbers coming out. And while that particular statistic is a pretty squishy one, the whole idea of confidence, when this is something Keynes wrote a lot about, that when we're feeling scared, we hold on to our money so much that that it actually creates the very conditions that we're scared of.
My guest is Adam Davidson, who writes the weekly It's the Economy column in the New York Times Sunday magazine. He's also co-founder and co-host of Planet Money for public radio. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Adam Davidson, co-founder and co-host of NPR's Planet Money, also author of the New York Times weekly column It's the Economy. How can happiness be quantified? What does it mean to be happy in this case?
This is such a huge puzzle. And it's one of I got very excited about studying this, because at the end of the day, a lot of economists like to say subjective well-being rather than happiness, because at the end of the day, what is the role of a government, of an economy, if it isn't to make us all feel better? If it does turn out that making more money turns out to make us feel worse, then we probably shouldn't make more money.
The Declaration of Independence even mentions happiness.
It does mention happiness, although it turns out when you translate happiness into other languages, it's not quite so clear that it has the exact same meaning. It also turns out that some cultures don't value happiness. They value filial piety or family values or some religious value higher than happiness. But well-being, the economists say, should capture things better. So the sort of state of the art now is this idea of having you run through your day yesterday. They say that gets rid of the immediacy bias. We don't ask you how do you feel right now because maybe you just had a really good sandwich or you just had a big fight with your boss or something. And so right this minute you're feeling bad. So they take you back one day, walk you through the whole day, and then they do this thing called the ladder of satisfaction where they say imagine a ladder. Zero is the worst possible life as you define it. 10 is the best possible life as you define it. Where are you right now? And what we see is as people get richer, as countries get richer, they move up that ladder. But a crucial thing, as I said, I grew up in the village in West Beth, all artist housing. And, you know, you would not make the artists in West Beth happier if you made them all become bankers, even if it would increase their income. It's not a one-to-one. Each person is happier to the extent they make money. But there is something about being in a country so rich that it can support a building full of artists that makes people happy.
On the other hand, West Beth has suffered because of cutbacks in government support. So the building is kind of falling apart, isn't it?
Well, it's...
Are you living there?
No, my dad lives there. And they have new elevators.
But it is a local thing, as you point out, that because in places like Nevada, which were hit hard, especially in the two big cities, Las Vegas and Reno, they're hit hard by the housing bust. The people are predictably less happy than their neighbors right across the border in Colorado.
Yeah, exactly. And you do see these local effects state by state. I was surprised to see that Brooklyn is a few notches less happy than Western Long Island right across. I guess that surprises me. I'd much rather live in Brooklyn, as I do personally.
But not for that reason, but... suburbs have become areas of more unhappiness in recent years. People are moving, many are moving back into the cities, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, I think that in America and around the world, money is a proxy for opportunity. And I know I've spent a fair bit of time in the Middle East, in Haiti, and in other parts of the developing world. And what you see is countries that are poorer come with a whole host of things that make you less happy. You have fewer options. Most people alive today, it's worth remembering, or almost half, are subsistence farmers who really have no choice in life. They barely can make enough calories to live.
And we can understand why people in Haiti are unhappy, but you say that the people in the Philippines are relatively happy. And I was surprised because that's a country that's had a lot of troubles, political corruption, and an on-again, off-again civil war.
Well, here's where you get into some of the cultural issues. So the Philippines scores high on every emotion asked about. When you ask people in the Philippines, are you happy? They're happier. Are you sadder? They're sadder. Are you angry? They're angrier. And whereas Singapore, for example, which is an unbelievably prosperous country and probably has grown in prosperity faster than any other in the 1960s, it was below Haiti, I believe. Singaporeans are the least emotive. So they're the least happy. They're also the least sad. They just, in general, don't respond intensely to emotion.
And they try not to chew gum because it can get them arrested.
Right. I guess that would make you unhappy right there.
You've written that the rise of technology is frequently cited as a culprit for our changing economic climate. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. It does seem that if you think of the major technological changes of the first phase of the Industrial Revolution, really from the 1700s, even depending if you want to start at the 1500s, right through to the 1970s, many of those changes help less skilled workers. So agricultural changes, the changes to the kind of stuff that Charlie Chaplin makes fun of. It's not that it was great to work in a conveyor belt mass production factory, but it increased the productivity of low-skilled workers and therefore brought higher wages to them. Since the 70s.
But they've resisted from the start. I mean, we get the word sabotage from the fact that workers were throwing their wooden shoes into the machinery.
Well, it always created tremendous short-term, it would send some people out of the workforce. But overall, that is why people live longer, why children live longer. But since the 70s, computer-aided everything, whether it's, you know, you're sitting here in a studio filled with computer-aided audio technology, and you and I both know we have fewer engineers. There used to be lots more engineers in public radio. In a factory, computer-run machines can do a lot of the heavy lifting that it used to take big, strong men to do. And so generally, when you're skilled, these computers help you. You and I probably make more money because of computers. But when you're less skilled or your skills are easily replaceable by technology, you make less money.
And it's been pointed out that although some manufacturing is returning to the United States, it doesn't necessarily mean that a lot of people are going to be hired for these new manufacturing jobs because it's coming back with a lot of robots doing the work.
I love going to factories. I go to as many factories as I can, and it is amazing how few people you can see in a factory. And the people you do meet more and more have, it's not just a high school degree. They need, you know, a few years of college, some advanced technical training. You and I could not do these jobs. We have nowhere near the skills.
So the rise in the use of computers, smartphones, all the other things, they're different than what we saw in the past with the telephone, radio, and TV?
That is the argument. It's called skilled bias technical change. It's a bit controversial among economists. Some particularly left-leaning economists argue, no, it's not that. It's a general anti-union, anti-labor stance of government and regulation that caused this. And there's certainly that certainly might be relevant. We're getting back to politics again. But it does seem everywhere in the world, including, you know, more union-friendly countries in Europe, where you see technological change, you do see increasing inequality and less opportunity for the low-skilled. Although the inequality is not as extreme in some parts of Europe as it is here in the U.S.
And skill-based technological or technical change is such a common term that they actually say SBTC.
Yeah, you could start a fight in a bar full of economists just by shouting out, SBTC, good or bad, you know.
Well, when I read something from an economist these days, my first thought is, what is this person's political leaning rather than what theory are we dealing with here? And so this becomes a big problem sometimes. Often you get the feeling that economists are skewing the numbers to prove their point.
I would say part of that is you get the opportunity to read the most political economists. I talk to lots and lots of economists, and my hunch would be a majority, maybe the vast majority, are like the majority of journalists I know. They might vote one way more often than the other way. They might have their biases, but they're really not angrily political. The thing is, those people don't get contracts to write op-ed columns. Those people are not called by TV bookers. They're
not working on think tanks.
They're not working on think tanks. They're doing quiet academic work. I do think that's the bulk of the field. There's a guy, just one example, Angus Madison at Princeton, who I love. He's such a measured, reasonable guy. And I was joking with him recently saying, you're never going to get a column because every column would just be this kind of measured, reasonable, well, this side says this side says that. I sort of lean this way, but I'm not 100% sure I'm right. I could be wrong. That's the conversation I have most often with economists, but it's not the conversation you hear in the press.
My guest is Adam Davidson, co-founder, co-host of Planet Money on public radio, also the author of the New York Times Weekly It's the Economy column. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Another big debate followed the President Obama's State of the Union address, where he said we should raise the minimum wage. And we hear the same arguments we've heard all along, even though we've raised minimum wage in the past, and it's turned out to be whatever it turned out to be. Neither side seems to be totally correct in its predictions.
I mean, the key thing is it's really low, and the raise, even though this is the most substantial raise in a long time, it's still very low.
And it's pointed out that a $10 minimum wage would still leave most people at about or below the poverty level.
Right. Although the argument against raising the minimum wage is that you want entry-level jobs for high school kids, for teenagers, for people who are the third or fourth income in a family, not the primary breadwinner. The people who argue against a minimum wage would argue that raising it too high. I experienced this in France, where the minimum wage, I believe, was something like 15 euros when I was there. I'm not 100% sure I'm right on that. But I went after the French riots, and I met a lot of these children of North African immigrants who really just were never going to have enough skill to get €15 an hour. Nobody was ever going to pay them that. And I found it compelling to argue that maybe when they're teenagers, finding some path to employment where they could make make less but acquire some skills would, over the long term, bring them more income and be healthier. In the U.S., when you're going from $7.25 to $9, it's just it's not enough money to really see a dramatic change like that.
Recently, a French company was about to fail, and it was thought that an American company would take it over. But the CEO of the American company said he wouldn't do it because French workers don't work very hard. He said they work 3 hours, and then they talk 3 hours, and then they have a long lunch.
Well, that's mathematically not true. French workers are remarkably productive.
Well, the French got very angry.
Yeah.
But he said it was all because of the French unions.
Yeah, well, I mean, France, like Germany, while the number of people in the unions might be small, the unions do govern most salaries. And there are rules in France that can strike us Americans as ridiculous. But that being said, the math is pretty clear. The average French worker on a per hour basis is more productive than the average American worker. The thing is, they do have the, you know, limited work hours, so they do work fewer hours. So
they're more productive. So the lean system that we're hearing about in this country is actually more in force in a country like France?
It's a bit of a puzzle why they're more productive, because it does seem counterintuitive. But I haven't seen the numbers, the very latest numbers. Overall, the French economy is considerably less productive than the U.S., but on a per-hour basis, French workers do seem to be as or more productive than American workers. Well, I found that surprising, too. You know, I that was a surprising finding.
We are at a 97-year low in terms of union labor union membership, just 11.3%. But it's been falling since the 50s.
It's been falling since the 50s.
Because of the right-to-work laws?
It's not clear. It seems to not be totally dependent on politics, because it's a fairly steady drop, even when you look at those key nodal moments. You know, in the late 70s, Jimmy Carter decided not to really strongly pursue some rewriting of the labor laws, which some people blame him for weakening unions. Certainly, obviously, the Patco strike, Ronald Reagan firing the air traffic controllers, which some people argue changed the norms and allowed for faster dismissal of striking union workers. I would say that, though, it does seem that there is something embedded in our economy, and it's probably related to technical change and increasing global trade, that just makes the ability of unions to attract workers or to coalesce workers around one incentive less and less.
In an installment in your New York Times column called "Do Illegal Immigrants Actually Hurt the U.S. Economy?", you argued that although this might have negative consequences for American-born citizens competing with undocumented workers for the same job, it can actually be beneficial to skilled workers.
It does seem to be the case. I'd say the sort of standard economist argument is that overall the average American benefits a little bit from the presence of illegal immigrants. Maybe you and I are something like 1% richer because there are illegal immigrants. This can be direct. We have access to, you know, I hate to say it, house cleaning services or car wash services that
are
cheaper.
And often jobs that Americans don't want to take. How many companies have complained that they put ads on the paper looking for workers and they don't get anybody, and then they're forced to hire undocumented?
Right. And the interesting thing is it does seem that undocumented workers can be complementary. So if you're, say, a skilled building contractor, you might get more – an American citizen, an immigrant or not, but a documented building contractor in Brooklyn, there's certainly plenty of them, you might be able to get more work because you hire skilled documented workers to do the skilled stuff, and then you hire less skilled undocumented immigrants to do the low-skill stuff. And you end up there's more work for everybody. The economy is richer. That's also counterintuitive, but the data is very compelling. When you look at those parts of the country with more undocumented workers, you actually see more demand for these services, more work for the skilled workers. The problem really is the low-skilled, often inner-city, poorly educated, the high school dropouts, folks who have very few opportunities, their income seems to fall dramatically, as much as 7-9%, depending on the studies you see, because they are the ones directly competing. And it does seem like they're the one group for whom this is a bad deal.
Well, you recently did a thing on Planet Money, economists, if economists controlled the borders. And I was amused by just how differently each economist viewed the situation.
Yeah. I mean, economists, I'd say broadly, economists are very pro-immigration and believe that we do, that our immigration policies are pretty stupid.
But some just want to bring in highly skilled people. Others felt that we should open up the borders to everybody. Nobody seemed to agree.
Right, right. They, that's typical of economists. They'll agree on the diagnosis, but the prognosis, or I mean, the prescription is radically, radically different. I find you can get left and right wing economists to agree on an awful lot when they're describing the stupid things politicians do. But then when you ask them what things that politicians should do, that's when they really disagree.
Well, one of the areas of disagreement is about internal immigrant affairs, such as the resources allocated to immigrant populations within the United States. Are we spending too much for their health care? Are we spending too much to educate their kids? How do you get past that?
I mean, this is a perfect case where to an economist, there's a very simple mathematical formula that solves this easily. At the federal level, overall, immigrants pay far more in taxes than they take. So if you think of a lot of undocumented workers live in an entirely black market cash economy, but a lot of undocumented workers pay taxes and don't take services. So there's a huge surplus at the federal level. But at the states and county and city level, where there are heavy populations, southern Arizona, much of Texas, New Mexico, parts of New York, Chicago, there's a huge deficit that immigrants use a lot of services. So if you had a formula that transferred the money from the federal government to those local governments that are most affected, then you should have an overall win-win. The problem is, of course, you then get into politics. You know, you'd need a Republican rural house to vote for a program that would send money to Democratic heavy cities. It's just not going to happen.
And I've heard of a situation in that happens in a number of towns where they've done everything possible to get rid of the undocumented immigrants. And then all of the businesses, the local businesses, suffered because those were the people who were buying milk and infant formula and actually were helping the mom-and-pop stores survive.
This is one of the biggest puzzles to me about the way immigrants are talked about. Sometimes they say, they're just competing for jobs. Yes, they are competing for jobs. They increase the supply of labor, but they also are demanding labor. They get haircuts, they buy cell phones, they buy milk. They spend the vast majority of their money they spend. So, I mean, I think Alabama, which has become a very, poster child for unfriendly programs, no other state is looking at Alabama and thinking, boy, I want what they have. It's seen as a disaster.
Adam, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, Lenny. This was really fun.
Adam Davidson is co-founder and co-host of NPR's Planet Money, and he's also the writer of the New York Times Weekly, It's the Economy column.